I'll take advantage of the hush then to start. So this is the final of our Milton-themed Lady Margaret lectures. The lecture series is in honour of Lady Margaret Beaufort, the founder of Christ College. And it's a great pleasure to welcome back to Christ's and to Cambridge our honorary fellow, Christopher Ricks, who's going to discuss Milton and the best criticism of any work. Christopher Ricks was in Cambridge at Christ's from 1975 to 1986, and at that time he was King Edward VII Professor of English Literature. He's currently Warren Professor of the Humanities and co-director of the Editorial Institute at Boston University and Professor of Poetry at the University of Oxford. A prolific author and editor, and as we shall see, a compelling lecturer, he is widely regarded as one of the most important critics of the post-war era. His many books include Keats and Embarrassment, The Force of Poetry, T.S. Eliot and Prejudice, Beckett's Dying Words, Allusion to the Poets, and Dylan's Visions of Sin. But he first made his name as the author of one of the most influential readings of Milton to date, Milton's Grand Style. And in this lecture, he looks at how 20th century poets have engaged with Milton. Christopher.
Thank you.
The quotation in my title is, of course, as one says on these occasions when one thinks that not everybody knows, is, of course, from Ezra Pound, who says, "The best criticism of any work, to my mind, the only criticism of any work of art that is of any permanent or even moderately durable value, comes from the creative writer or artist who does the next job." And he speaks of La Forgue's Salome, or Salome, as the real criticism of Salambo, and he speaks of Joyce and perhaps Henry James as critics of Flaubert. I'd want to make two exceptions to what Pound says. I think it's a great truth. I think there are two exceptions, that having priority even over that is the self-criticism that the artist devotes to his or her work. So the best criticism of any work is actually that bent upon it by the creator of it. And in any performing art, again taking priority even over what Pound rightly adduces, of any performing art, the most important criticism is a performance. The greatest criticism of any play is a performance of it, or of any work of music. But with those exceptions, it seems to me that what Pound says is a very, very profound and unforgettable truth. T.S. Eliot picks up the notion of dislike, which I will return to, says about Goethe, "What I chiefly dislike about Goethe is the fact that he is having a centenary. I always dislike everybody at the centenary moment." And the word moment is very good. So presumably a quatercentenary, a fortiori, dislike could be multiplied. And as we know, Eliot did dislike and repudiate Milton. That's in 1935. In 1947, he repudiated his repudiation, or at any rate toyed with repudiating it. But lifelong, his own art could not do without Milton's art. And Frank Kermode set this down in the immediate wake of Eliot's death, a very memorable essay where Frank Kermode says, "The more we see of the hidden side of Eliot, the more he seems to resemble Milton, though he thought of Milton as a polar opposite." I didn't have the privilege and pleasure of hearing these previous lectures, and I am especially sorry, without insulting any of the others, that I didn't hear Geoffrey Hill on Milton as muse. Milton's fecundations of later writers are absolutely extraordinary in their range and depth and variety, so I'm obliged to choose one aspect of the influence that he had, or the fertility that he manifested, and this I can get at through reverting for a moment to Ezra Pound. Pound says, "The sin or error of Milton, let me leave off vague expressions of a personal active dislike and make my year-long diatribes more coherent. Honour where it is due." That's the moment when you really flinch when you're reading this. "Milton undoubtedly built up the sonority of the blank verse paragraph in our language, but he did this at the cost of his idiom. I am leaving apart my disgust at what he has to say, his asinine bigotry, his beastly Hebraism, the coarseness of his mentality. Good of Ezra Pound not to mention those things. So the aspect under which I want to, that I wish to attend to tonight is, of course, an aspect of blasphemy or sacrilege. I'll say something about the differentiation, but it now feels that Pound's remarks are sacrilegious and are verging on the blasphemous and so on. Coleridge, one of the greatest Milton critics, says of Milton this: his poetry belongs to the whole world. It is alike the property of the churchman and the dissenter, the Protestant and the Catholic, the monarchist and the Republican, and of every country on earth, except the kingdom of Dahomey in Africa, for the present at least, and of France, so long as it shall be inhabited by Frenchmen, forever! speaking about the infidel wantonness of a commentator, he refers to the French lust of blasphemy, and the blasphemies of French lust. For it is twofold blasphemy, blasphemy against religion and blasphemy against common sense. Now, Milton himself writes very powerfully about blasphemy, taking advantage of the fact that the etymology of the word blame is blasphemy. That is, he takes advantage of that in the very beautiful opening of Book 3, and I'll read 6 or 8 lines. Hail, I'll say one thing. Book 2 ends with he hies. Accursed and in a cursed hour, he hies. Book 3 begins with that same alliteration. Have 4 consecutive words with this breathy, vengeful hatred at the end of Book 2 and with adoration and awe and inspiration at the beginning of Book 3. And, of course, they're successive, but they're extraordinarily punctuated by moving from one book of the great epic to the next book. So, accursed and in a cursed hour, he hies. Hail, holy light, offspring of heaven firstborn, or of the eternal, co-eternal beam, may I express thee unblamed, since God is light, and never but in unapproached light dwelt from eternity, dwelt then in thee, bright effluence of bright essence increate. Or hearest thou rather pure ethereal stream, whose fountain who shall tell? It's a wonderful moment that the line, or of the eternal, or of the eternal, co-eternal beam, rhymes with, or hearest thou rather pure ethereal stream. That the two lines that are syntactically parallel then have these rhymes, and of course that wonderful freedom in rhyme which Milton granted himself by not being obliged to rhyme in every line. But may I express the unblamed is what can one possibly say of God that does not fall short and does not verge on or commit blasphemy? And the modern commentators will gloss this as, or may I, without committing blasphemy, describe you as being co-eternal with God. But as I say, taking advantage of an etymology. Andrew Marvel, in the poem on Paradise Lost, which is added in the second edition, begins, I think, with a wonderful turn through beheld. When I beheld the poet, blind yet bold. Very wonderful movement, that not when I imagine or think of, when I beheld the poet, blind yet bold, in slender book his vast design unfold, Messiah crowned, God's reconciled decree, rebelling angels, the forbidden tree, heaven, hell, earth, chaos. All the argument held me a while, misdoubting his intent, that he would ruin, for I saw him strong, the sacred truth to fable and old song. Now, what happens there is, I think, something more than what the commentators mostly say. That is, the commentators are right to think that held me a while misdoubting his intent should include fearing that he had taken on too much. But misdoubting his intent goes beyond that, and moves, of course, to speaking of Samson groped the temple's posts in spite. In spite, and the commentators bring out that's not ordinarily how the Samson story is told, that it's a matter of spite. The Marvel poem moves on and claims to fear only the outcome, not the enterprise itself, not the intent in the modern sense. But I think that the impiety of which Marvel speaks here, pardon me, mighty poet, nor despise my causeless yet not impious surmise, the impiety is knocking about in Paradise Lost and in Marvel's own sense of it. And I want, therefore, to talk about accusability for a while. That is, I take it that there can be no great religious art that is not accusable of blasphemy. If the accusation doesn't arise, that can only be because you played so safe as to be incompatible with greatness and its aspirations. That is, I think if the accusation sticks, then the art would fall short of the greatest religious art. But if the accusation doesn't arise, it cannot be, I think, great art. I'm not just saying that the great artists have always been found incomprehensible, have always been found offensive, and I'm not saying that. I'm saying that risking offence, it seems to me, is absolutely essential. Accusability, that is, works of art cannot afford to be unimpeachable. Minor works of art can risk a greater degree of unimpeachability than major ones, but I think that there is no great erotic art that does not risk the accusation of pornography or of prurience. That is, if the question never even arose in the apprehension of erotic art, it would seem to me that it has to be falling short of really high aspiration. And I think there is no great literature about the relations between the sexes that is not accusable of sexism. All the great writers have been accused of sexism whenever they engage with relations between the sexes. And it doesn't matter if it's Henry James or Jane Austen, it doesn't matter who it is. The accusation, in some important way, has at least to be countered by something, or so I believe. Now, I'm going to therefore talk about blasphemy. I want to remind you of T.S. Eliot's position. I'll come back to him on blasphemy. What I'm meaning to do is to talk a while about Milton and blasphemy, to talk too about blasphemy, and then to talk about the particular indebtedness which the great poets have had in this matter of being willing to risk blasphemy, to incur the risk, but at the same time, in the end, to keep very, very precisely on this side, blasphemy. This side, idolatry, because idolatry is always blasphemy. Isn't it? Idolatry has to be blasphemy, though it may also be other things. Eliot, you'll remember, claims that blasphemy is possible only to a believer, or at least to someone who half fears that he or she may be a believer, and who is kicking against the pricks. For Eliot, the decay of blasphemy is a symptom of the decay of belief. He says, genuine blasphemy, genuine in spirit and not purely verbal, is the product of partial belief. And it is as impossible to the complete atheist as to the complete Christian. But of course the point there is that nobody must think of himself as a complete Christian. It's a good idea to be urged to be ye perfect even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect, provided you don't suppose you can achieve it. Isn't that right? That is, the urging is always to be held against the impossibility. And anybody who was sure that he was a perfect Christian would, by that very token, not be, seems to me. That is, faith requires your not knowing, and it is in a very imperfect state to suppose that you could achieve perfection. Eliot, in 1927, that crucial year in which he enters the Church of England and writes some of his very, very greatest literary criticism, Eliot says, the 12th century anomaly, he points to, and yet the essential congruity of the finest religious verse and the most brilliant blasphemous verse to the present generation of versifiers, so deficient in devotion and so feeble in blasphemy, the 12th century might offer an edifying subject of study. I like that curious kind of chill that comes at the end, an edifying subject, and so on. Now, my point isn't the Shavian one. When Shaw says all great truths begin as blasphemies, that the partial truth of that is worth thinking about, but that's not quite what I'm saying. I'm saying that all great realizations of truths in works of art have to risk the accusation of blasphemy. Empson's book, Milton's God, did of course risk prosecution for blasphemy. Cambridge has a notable part in the history of the prosecution for blasphemy, as many people will know, and as Mark Boxer knew very, very painfully at this university. Empson thought he would be prosecuted for blasphemy, and this was not simply paranoid, in that his publisher expected they would both be prosecuted for blasphemy. It's recorded in Hathaway. And the blasphemy, of course, is that the reason why the poem is so good is that it makes God so bad. It doesn't even make God so bad, it shows that God is bad in a way that is highly persuasive to Empson and to some others of us. And the person to whom Empson keeps returning in that first essay of his on Milton is, of course, Richard Bentley, who posited that there was so much blasphemy and sacrilege in the poem that it cannot have been written by Milton. That is, it is written by somebody called the editor, who repeatedly misunderstands what Milton meant to write, and foists in these carelessnesses which start to build up to a betrayal of a blasphemous impulse and so on. Empson, with a wonderful turn of phrase in the essay on Milton and Bentley, he's talking about the arguments between Pierce and Zachary Pierce and Richard Bentley. One has only to compare such dualists as Pierce and Bentley, who raise questions at every point, however they fail to answer them, which concern the essence of the poetry they are considering, with the mild and tactful hints, the air of a waiter, anxious not to interrupt the conversation, of a sensible 19th century editor like Masson. So you go back to the 18th century when they were not sensible, but when they did raise real questions of sense. Adam and Eve, this is one of Empson's instances. Yet of their port, not of mean suitors, nor important less, seem their petition, than when the ancient pair, in fables old, less ancient yet than these, Deucalion and Chaste Pyrrha, to restore the race of mankind drowned, before the shrine of Themis stood devout, Bentley. But was the man bewitched with his old fables, but not as old as these? Is Adam and Eve's history an old fable, too, by this editor's own insinuation? Milton intends no unorthodoxy, Empson says, but there is something suspicious, at least, in the lines. Or again, you'll remember this of Empson's. He describes the most firmly pagan... It's this thing doing it, isn't it? I'm wearing a tie which has a toad on it. because of squat like a toad close at the ear of Eve. And these days there'd be a lot more toads.
I see what's happened. It's dropped.
What we need is a caryatid to stand and hold this for me.
Thank you, baby.
Thank you. The Master of Christ takes on himself. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
The lines. The most firmly pagan, and I think the most beautiful of the comparisons, Empson says. In shadier bower, more sacred and sequestered, though but feigned, Pan or Sylvanus never slept, nor nymph nor Faunus haunted. Bentley. Pan, Sylvanus, and Faunus, savage and beastly deities, and acknowledged feigned, are brought here in comparison, and their wild grottos, forsooth, are sacred. Now, he's responding to something which is in the lines about, and Empson writes very beautifully about them, and the crucial instance is this one, Satan. O foul descent, that I, who erst contended with gods to sit the highest, am now constrained into a beast, and mixed with bestial slime, this essence to incarnate, and imbrute, that to the height of deity aspired. Bentley. Milton would not use the word incarnate. He knew a higher essence than seraphical was afterwards incarnated. Now, it's a profound insight into the poem, and it is, of course, about the blasphemy, the being on the edge of blasphemy, not only Satan's being on the edge of it, but Milton's being on the edge of it. So it has to be foisted in by an editor. Now, I haven't time or the theological capacity to distinguish the varieties of offence, scandal, impiety, which can be differentiated from the unorthodox or the heterodox, and where the differentiations are often important. Roger's Thesaurus will say, be impious, profane, desecrate, blaspheme, revile, scoff, commit sacrilege. Revile and scoff are only, of course, blasphemous if you give them a particular context, so they do differ from blaspheme in that way. And I'm setting aside heresy, on which Eliot writes very profoundly, Eliot as heresy as a half-truth that claims to be the whole truth. And that's the particular concept of heresy which Eliot writes about. And I'm not really going to talk about idolatry especially. The the entry in the Oxford English Dictionary for blasphemy clearly risks blasphemy, because it says to speak irreverently of utter impiety at, and then within brown brackets, God. If I were God, I'd be extremely irritated to be put into a parenthesis and so on. To speak irreverently or utter impiety of God or anything sacred. Now, I mean, this is not a wise way to put it, is it? Profane speaking of God or sacred things. So God isn't a sacred thing. I mean, you've got to watch your words when you're creating these dictionaries, especially in Victorian England. Sacrilege, I insufficiently understood till I looked it up. I have not taken the force of its being the crime or sin of stealing or misappropriating what is consecrated to God's service. The biggest single difference between sacrilege and blasphemy is that there is no verb going with sacrilege. It's a very, very important fact that you have to go to commit sacrilege. It's a very extraordinary fact about the word rhythm, for instance, that it seems to be so full of verb-like energy, and there isn't a verb for it. Rhythmicize, rhythmize, they none of them caught on. They're embalmed beautifully and necessarily in the OED, but something is told us about the nature of rhythm by the fact that it has never lent itself to a verb, as something is told us about the nature of truth, that the verb to truth, or to truthify, did not survive. To lie is as easy as lying, but to truth, no. To speak the truth, to tell the truth, you have a circumlocution of some sort is necessary in order to engage with the concept at all. And I think that is a profound difference between sacrilege and blasphemy, that there isn't a verb. Johnson's dictionary is, of course, the greatest dictionary hereabouts, because Johnson was so deeply frightened, more than frightened, deeply awed and terrified by blasphemy. One, blaspheme. To speak in terms of impudence, irreverence of God. No instance is given. Very, very extraordinary in the dictionary when you don't get any quotations to illustrate the word. And this is because to quote anything would, of course, itself be an act of impious irreverence. So suppose that lexicography, however important, should engage in putting before us instances. Blasphemer, a wretch that speaks of God in impious and irreverent terms. There you have instances, they are all explicitly of God, and they include Pope. Should each blasphemer quite escape the rod, because the insult's not to man, but God. That movement of mind. Blasphemous, similarly, blasphemously. Sacrilege, similarly. I was reminded recently, earlier this month in the Times, there was a very good letter, I don't know if you saw it, from Matthew Cobb at the University of Manchester, complaining about JC's endless resort in, recourse and resort in the Times Literary Supplement to what he calls the FCUK. Ization of everything. And the letter pointed out that if you're really against it, it's not a good idea repeatedly and repeatedly, whenever you run out of anything amusing to say, to give all these instances of people doing it. That is, it's like the attack on pornography, which just feel obliged to put before us salivatingly a few instances of how bad it is and so on. So something's happening, and that's part of the passage of the conduct of mind that's very, very important in Johnson's decision under blaspheme. No instances, give no instances. And the famous account of religious or contemplative poetry in the life of Waller is about the offence that is given by supposing that man admitted to implore the mercy of his Creator and plead the merits of his Redeemer, to deny that such a man is already in a higher state than poetry can confer. So the whole of that very powerful argument by Johnson says that to write religious poetry, and contemplative poetry in particular, is mistaken, and it's worse than mistaken because it is blasphemous. That is, it is blasphemous because poetry loses its lustre and its power because it is applied to the decoration of something more excellent than itself. Theological truths are too sacred for fiction. And there is a kind of sacrilege, therefore, in supposing that you can convert them to whatever, however high and noble your form of fiction in poetry, there's something ignoble about supposing you can do so. Johnson, you'll remember, says of Paradise Lost and of his agents, the weakest of his agents are the highest and noblest of human beings. The next paragraph begins, of the other agents in the poem, the chief are such as it is irreverence to name on slight occasions.
Milton might have disliked the idea that discussing his poem was a slight occasion. I mean, there's a huge contrast in his natural Porter's gigantic loftiness and the fact that Johnson is quite clear that he must not discuss God. It's irreverence even to name God here. And again, the characters in the Paradise Lost which admit of examination are those of angels and of man. And it's a very profound religious conviction in Johnson, which supposes that he may not discuss those characters who are neither angels nor men, because they do not admit of examination. Now, Milton himself uses blasphemy always to mean against God. That is, in the poems he does. I want to make a differentiation. In the prose, it becomes incumbent on him to go to a wider definition of blasphemy because of his resisting the charge that he has himself been blasphemous. But Paradise Lost, it is always that God should not be questioned and blasphemed. That for this he shall live hated, be blasphemed. And so on. It's always within that very, very clear context. In the prose, though, it will take this form. But some are ready to cry out, what then shall be done to blasphemy? Them I would first exhort not thus to terrify and pose the people with a Greek word, but to teach them better what it is, being a most usual and common word in that language, to signify any slander, any malicious or evil speaking, whether against God or man or anything to good belonging. So he wishes to take a very wide view of what blasphemy is, but I hope you can see that this itself risks blasphemy. That is, what it does is bring as equally blasphemable God and anything to good belonging. That is, it will always be, it's built into it that it will always be an injustice and a misrepresentation, but it's not a monopoly possessed by God. It doesn't have to be divine. And he returns to this repeatedly. And he also warns us at the same time that another Greek apparition stands in our way, heresy and heretic. And he objects to the reduction to entirely divine context of those words too. To hallow it in word, this is of course translation because it's from the De Doctrina Christiana, to hallow it in word is never to name it but with a religious purpose. But then he says he wishes to widen the concept of blasphemy. And it's the widening over the centuries that seems to me to be especially important. You can think that anything sacred can have sacrilege committed upon it, but how true is it that only God can be blasphemed? Which is, I think, what happens in Paradise Lost, though, as I say, it doesn't happen elsewhere. God manifestly, so here's Coleridge on Donne. Donne, a letter in 1611, Madam, my best treasure is time, and my best employment of that, lunulae. Next, my thoughts of thankfulness for my Redeemer is to study good wishes for you. Now, Coleridge is profoundly offended by the tucking up of the Redeemer within lunulae, within round brackets. He says, the thoughts played upon are of so serious a nature, and the exception in the parenthesis is so awful that the wit, instead of carrying off, aggravates the flattery, and Donne must either have been literally sincere or adulatory to extravagance and almost to blasphemy. Now, and almost is wishing to hold that little bit which has done not be blasphemous, but be almost blasphemous. Those of us who teach are always telling our students not to use the word almost. Isn't that right? I mean, it's not at this point that Yeats was almost fascistic. Please think out the ways in which the word fascist would be right and the ways in which it would be wrong. Don't say of a writer that he's almost insane. Think about the ways in which insane is the right and cover certain things that, as evil people say, unpack. This word and so on. But you can have the argument as to whether you can have blasphemy against anything other than God is a profoundly important one. If you think, as Blake does, or at least think at that moment, that everything that lives is holy, then presumably everything can be blasphemed. If you think that the real question not is, is nothing sacred, but is not everything sacred, then you can have a certain view by which the widening of the term will not give you discomposure, will not be disconcerting. But for a lot of us, it is disconcerting. Other than God, therefore, blasphemed against. Well, there are kings because of the divine right of kings. Coleridge is particularly good on the way in which these themselves constitute blasphemies. He's writing about John Hackett.
this perversion of words respecting the decrees of Providence to the caprices of James and his beslobbered minion, the Duke of Buckingham, is somewhat nearer to blasphemy than even the euphuisms of the age can excuse. Somewhat nearer to. He doesn't want to come out tout court and say it's blasphemous, but he knows that it risks blasphemy, and he thinks that he thinks the accusation actually will then stick here. On Hayley's Milton and its praise of King Charles I, what would the contemptible martyr worshippers who yearly apply to this fraudulent would-be despot the most awful phrases of Holy Writ concerning the saviour of mankind, concerning the incarnate word that is with God and is God, in a cento of ingenious blasphemy that has no parallel in the annals of impious adulation, what would even these men have? It's very, very important that it's kings upon whom this is bent. That is the easy move from blaspheming God to blaspheming a king who is so by divine right. At the other end, there's the Skinhead Hamlet. I don't know how many of you know the Skinhead Hamlet. It's by Richard Curtis, and it reduces every scene of Hamlet to the FCUK word that fascinates James Campbell in the Times Literary Supplement. So every scene has somebody simply swearing at somebody else. And actually, there's a lot of that going on in the play, though there's more decorum. The Skinhead Hamlet, the note at the beginning by the editors says, Shakespeare's play translated into modern English. It then says, our hope was to achieve something like the effect of the New English Bible. Then, of course, you've got blasphemy against literary genius. Here's an exchange involving Milton, again, Coleridge. He's the second speaker, as he says interruptively himself. Do you not think, sir, I declare I do, that Sir Walter Scott is equal to Shakespeare, said Mr. Terry. I know, sir, that something him inferior to Lord Byron in genius, and certainly Lord Byron is a stupendous creature, but not equal to the Bard of Avon or the Northern Enchanter, interruptively, I replied, but you, I am sure, will rank him on a par with Milton. Don't you think Lord Byron nearer to Dante, sir? Sir, I was talking nonsense, not blasphemy. But which of those, I mean, is there a point at which nonsense becomes blasphemy? Is it not a porous distinction and so on? Or blasphemy against the calling of a poet, you see, the particular genius poets, where it feels blasphemous and or sacrilegious, so to speak, against the calling of a poet. This is John Dennis attacking Pope. And can such a creature, they go repeatedly to the word creature because it summons creator, it's not just a wretch, but not just a wretch, it's a creature as opposed to the creator. And can such a creature as this be deserving of the noble name of a poet, the name and function which he has so much blasphemed? Pope as blaspheming not only against God, but against the name and function of a poet. Or, of course, against beauty. You should look up the Samuel Butler poem, which I always remember as O God, O Montreal. I'd forgotten it was called Psalm of Montreal, but it is about blasphemy against beauty. Nonetheless, blasphemed he beauty, saying, the Discobulus hath no gospel, but my brother-in-law is haberdasher to Mr. Spurgeon. It's one of the great known sequiturs in poetry, I think, but it is about blasphemy, about the gospel. Prefers thou the gospel of Montreal to the gospel of Hellas? Each of those great civilizations has a gospel, and this one's on. A.E. Houseman, again, one could spend a whole hour attending to Houseman, the blasphemy in Houseman, where the blasphemy, the repeated recurrence to sacred text, Christ, after all, says of himself, a greater than Solomon is here. Houseman rests it to a greater than Lachman is here. Now, he did admire Lachman, as I was telling. Light now, darkness we beseech thee, O Lord. When these scholars ask me these questions, they are not beseeching me to lighten their darkness. Nothing is further from their desire. They hope and believe that they are asking me awkward questions, questions which I, in my precipitancy, have forgotten to ask myself. And accordingly, like Pilate of old, they do not stay for an answer. Now, that takes an immense lot upon itself and so on. And what is the blasphemy that Houseman is... What is sacred to Houseman? What is sacred to Houseman is the application of thought to textual criticism, and that's sacred to him because, as he says, nothing seems to him feebler in human nature than the love of truth. So blasphemy against the love of truth is what it is that's being, that in the service of that challenge that's being mounted. Human nature is, I suppose, the widest such term. This is House from Leibniz. This is Coleridge again on Richard Payne Knight. Richard Payne Knight, thinking about family relations, says, in the lower orders of society, the parental affections generally die away as in the brute creation. Rather great remarks about class in England and so on. Coleridge, God Almighty. Now, that must have been God Almighty, what blasphemy against human nature, and what a lie. And that's an interesting qualification, isn't it? I mean, as if it were not built into a blasphemy, that it would necessarily be a lie, whereas one would, etc. Bruce Redford, a very good book, new book of his called Dilettante on the Antic and the Antique in 18th century England. He's got a very good account of Richard Payne Knight and the blasphemous paintings to which, as a dilettante, Payne Knight subscribes. And it is in the book that Eliot wished not to reprint, that is, After Strange Gods, that you have the most sustained account by Eliot of the history of blasphemy, with a capital B. I mean, it's a sustained plea that such a thing be mounted. He mounts it himself only in a page or two. Modern blasphemy is merely a department of bad form. And that, of course, not only is offensive and ridiculous, but it is blasphemy against the notion of blasphemy. That is, blasphemy itself is imperiled if it becomes merely a department of bad form. No one can possibly blaspheme in any sense except that in which a parrot may be said to curse, unless he profoundly believes in that which he profanes. And when anyone who is not a believer is shot by blasphemy, he's shot merely by a breach of good form. And that's Eliot's position. Now, so what I want to do for the rest of my time, please, is say something about the way in which poets since Milton have, I think, understood what he has realised in his work. And he's realised it in his work, in his poetry, much more clearly than in his disputatious prose, where he has pushed, I think, to distort his deepest convictions in order not to be himself accusable of blasphemy. So I just want to remind you, I'll take from each age a poet greatly indebted in this way, where blasphemy is in the immediate vicinity of summoning Milton. The blasphemy, for instance, can be against the whole classical civilization, as it is in Pope. And the great blasphemer, of course, for Pope is Richard Bentley. Because Richard Bentley, in refusing to understand Milton's genius and his reduction of Milton to a dead text, blasphemes against the classics. The note to Dunciad, Book 3, the second Dunciad, the note says, the caution against blasphemy here given by a departed son of dullness to his yet existing brethren is, as the poet rightly intimates, not out of tenderness to the ears of others, but their own. That's the cropping of your ears. And so we see that when that danger is removed on the open establishment of the goddess, that is dullness in the fourth book, she encourages her sons, and they beg assistance to pollute the source of light itself with the same virulence they had before done the purest emanations from it. Yet, O my sons, a father's words attend, so may the fates preserve the ears you lend. 'Tis yours a bacon or a lock to blame, a Newton's genius or a Milton's flame. But oh, with one immortal one dispense the source of Newton's light, of Bacon's sense, content each emanation of his fires that beams on earth, each virtue he inspires, each art he prompts, each charm he can create, whate'er he gives, are given for you to hate. Persist by all divine in man unawed, but learn ye dunces not to scorn your God. It's entirely about blasphemy. It's wonderfully at one with something in Milton. It's able to be distant. It's able not to be taken over by Milton because of the decision to use the heroic couplet. I'm not saying there are no heroic couplets in Paradise Lost, but they are very, very rare. And the feeling, therefore, that the whole medium is distancing sufficiently a cordon sanitaire between Pope's achievement and Milton's own. You'll remember the description of Bentley in Book 4 of the Dunciad, and again explicitly raising Milton not simply as a text marred or mutilated by Bentley, but as a text against which blasphemy is being committed. Before them marched that awful Aristarch. Ploughed was his front with many a deep remark. His hat, which never veiled to human pride, Walker with reverence took and laid aside. Low bowed the rest, he kingly did but nod. So upright Quakers, please, both man and God. Mistress, dismiss that rabble from your throne. Avaunt, is Aristarchus yet unknown, thy mighty scholiast, whose unwearied pains made Horace dull and humbled Milton's strains? The idea of humbling Milton in any way being a very exceptional challenge, and full of little local felicities. What a bit of luck that the man in question is called Walker. So you can go before them marched, and then it's diminished into Walker with reverence, and just that lovely onomastic play which Pope everywhere delights in, as of course Milton did. The beginning of Book 2 of the Dante, where of course we have an important variant as to which is the satanic figure. High on a gorgeous seat that far outshone on Henley's gilt tub, or Flecknoe's Irish throne, or that where on her curls the public pours all bounteous fragrant grains and golden showers, great Tybalt sat, or great Cibber sat, or great Cibber sat, if you believe that the puns on Cibber and Kybe will take over the alliteration of Satan and so on. And of course the note to that says parody of Milton with a stronger sense of what parody is. I mean, that is, it's not, it just doesn't have to banter the original. Though whether mock heroic mocks that which it uses is very important, because it always risks, therefore, some kind of blasphemy or sacrilege. The opening of Book 4, yet a moment, one dim ray of light, indulge, dread chaos and eternal night, of darkness visible, so much be lent, as half to show, half veil, the deep intent. I think intent is coming in there because of Marvel. What was the deep intent of Milton? Was it, as Empson believed, that his feelings were crying out against his appalling theology? And that for Empson it is a great work in the Blakean tradition that he was a true poet and of the devil's party without knowing it. Where it's not just that he was of the devil's party and didn't know it, it's a condition of being a true poet that you not be fully conscious of that which you are creating. Darkness visible, perhaps all blasphemy is a form of darkness visible. And Pope is regularly drawn in his allusions to Milton to dark moments, as if there's something murkily concealed. Now I go to a much lighter poet, I go to Wordsworth. I'll just have instances. Sorry, I have to remind myself of what time I started, forgive me. Here's a moment in Wordsworth which I think is insufficiently represented as taking great risks in its relation to Milton. And it's the moment in Prelude Book 11 when he thinks of those who were called upon to exercise their skill not in utopia, subterranean fields, or some secreted island, heaven knows where, but in the very world, which is the world of all of us, the place where in the end we find our happiness or not at all. Now, it is a terrific challenge to the religion. I mean, it has to be seen as that. The place where in the end we find our happiness or not at all does have to put forward an extraordinary view of the afterlife. And it is heavily Miltonic, not just because of subterranean, not just because of fields, not just because of happy fields, which are, of course, the hideously unhappy ones of hell, but because of world. All this world, all, it's there very strongly, of all of us, where we find our happiness or not at all. Empson, you'll remember, picked out the word all in the structural complex words as the Milton word, this extraordinary intensity behind all. And of course it's Milton who gives you that sequence of world into world. But in the very world, which is the world of all of us, and so on. It's a double world within the line. And it's Milton who gives you that brought into this world a world of woe. The world ere long a world of tears must weep, betwixt the world destroyed and world, I beg pardon, between the world destroyed and world restored. It's very powerfully Miltonic. I'm not saying that the lines are not very powerful if you don't take up them, but they are a serious engagement and confrontation with Milton as a great Christian poet. And the change of subterraneous to subterranean in the later prelude brings them closer to the crucial passage in Book 1. Subterranean wind transports a hill, happy fields, infernal world and that profoundest hell, not where you find your happiness. So he would, Wordsworth, this instance will be my instance from the great romantic poets. My Victorian instance is from a poet, in my opinion, insufficiently known, a man called James Henry. I've been introduced to giving lectures in America as having edited Henry James's poems. You and I know there are not poems by Henry James and so on, or at least it would be a wonderful thing to turn up someday. It is true that I only ever read James Henry because in the university library here, I saw a run of books by James Henry and was tickled by the fact that he was not Henry James. And I therefore took one of them down. They'd been presented to the library in the 1860s and their pages had never been cut. They'd been presented by the author who had them printed at his own expense in Dresden and they were lying forever there. So in a moment of compassion and something, I cut the pages and found this extraordinary poet. A poet who is interested in the power of blasphemy and the need to risk blasphemy. What Coleridge says, there's the blasphemy that makes God the author of sin, without avoiding it by fleeing to the almost equal blasphemy, a blasphemy against the conscience. Almost equal because one must not quite give blasphemy against the conscience, the standing one gives the other. James Henry has poems about eternal torment, about burning people at the stake, about the problems of limbo. He has poems about, here's a short poem, which two lines, and then six lines. Who's the great sinner? He who gave the power and will to sin and knew both would be used. Who's the great sinner? He to whose soul will sinner and sin alike owe their existence. Who's the great sinner? He who, being omniscient, foresees all sins, and being omnipotent, can, if he please, prevent them, and does not. Nay, not alone does not, but punishes. And one tick farther still, one farther tick incredible, when punishment's no use. Now, these were bold poems to publish in Victorian England. I mean, he didn't flee the country because of that. And I'm just going to give a poem of his, which I think has a different timbre and so on. It has as an epigraph, Adam, the goodliest man of men since born his sons, the fairest of her daughters, Eve, famous crux in the poem. So Father Adam was his own born son, and her own fairest daughter, Mother Eve, and Father Adam was his own son's brother and sister of her daughter's Mother Eve, and Father Adam of himself was father, and mother of herself was Mother Eve, and Father Adam was his own grandfather, and great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather, and great-great-great-grandfather without end. And Mother Eve was her own grandmother, and great-grandmother, and great-great-grandmother, and great-great-great-grandmother without end. But Mother Eve was Father Adam's wife, and Father Adam's sons were Mother Eve, so Mother Eve was Father Adam's mother, and grandmother of Father Adam's sons, and grandmother of Father Adam's self, and great-grandmother, and great-great-grandmother, and great-great-great-grandmother without end. And Father Adam, being the lawful husband of Mother Eve, and father of her daughters, was Mother Eve's own father and grandfather, and great-grandfather, and great-great-grandfather, and great-great-great-grandfather without end. And Mother Eve was Father Adam's sister, aunt, and grand-aunt, and niece, and cousin German, and Father Adam, Mother Eve's own brother, uncle, granduncle, nephew and full cousin, and Father Adam was his own son's cousin, and Father Adam's sons and Mother Eve's daughters were cousins, all among each other, and intermarrying had sons and daughters, goodliest of whom was still old Father Adam, fairest of whom was still old Mother Eve. Now, it's like Beckett. I mean, it's a demented sort of permutation game by this wonderful Irishman who thought it's not a good idea to have gods at all. If you've got to have them, if you want a trinity, here's my trinity. It's going to be, he says, were I to idolatry addicted, you, Prometheus, should be my god in preference to Buddha, Brahma or Thor or Odin or Jove's self. Her of the olive branch, she would be the next member, and the last member, the last third person of my trinity, should be the inventor of the steering candle. He that enabled me to sit the long midwinter nights in study by a light which neither flickers nor offends the nostrils, nor from the distance of 1,000 miles or 1,000 years, or both perhaps, keeps ever and anon calling me like some bold child the mother's arm to come and snuff and snub it. But steady, cleanly, bright and inodorous, more steady, cleanly, bright and inodorous than tallow more humane, than wax less costly, gives me just what I want and asks back nothing. That's what he loves in the Cat. So this will be the third memory. And these are the poems that he writes because, as his friend Mahaffey, he said to Mahaffey that in his Virgilian commentary, he was thinking he would compare Christianity and paganism, in favour of which, Mahaffey says, of paganism, of course, was the reply. Then said Mahaffey, I would advise you to say nothing about it. And it was quite good advice, though Mahaffey is himself the author of a blasphemous witticism. Asked by a young man in the street if he was saved, he paused and answered, I am, but between you and me it was a damn close squeak. So, if I could do more, I would want to talk about Eliot's blasphemies against humanism, which he did believe in. That is, he didn't collect the essay on the price that religion paid for believing it could do without humanism. His essay on religion without humanism is at least as telling as the ones that he wrote on the other side, and he chose not to collect that one, and that was wrong of him, because it is a very noble account of why humanism must be deeply and unremittingly respected. It's about the price paid by religion if it thinks it can afford to condescend humanism. That will be Eliot, and of course it's always in the vicinity of Milton, because Sweeney Erect is not only the sexual and other puns that people have spoken of, but is Milton's cadence. And you don't find the cadence elsewhere. It's too a far nobler shape, erect and tall, godlike erect. So that Sweeney, the word under erasure, as those evil people who I mentioned earlier say, the words under erasure are, of course, godlike. Sweeney, not as you might have thought, godlike erect. So the poem is about that, as of course a lot of the risks and blasphemies in Eliot are. Oh, dark, 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 they all go into the dark. Now, the second half of that line is an extraordinary affront to Sam's Agonistes, isn't that right? I mean, the one thing that the rhythm of that does is repudiate the rhythm of Sam's Agonistes. So you take those great words, oh, dark, 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 and then you give them this strange lightness on the balls of their feet. They all go into the dark, and so it moves on. Geoffrey Hill, the blasphemy that it seems to me that he most concerns himself with now is blasphemy against history, and especially his understanding that blasphemy can be both sacred and profane, because profane does not have to mean profaning. That is, the sacred and profane distinction can be perfectly well one that thinks of the sacred and the secular, that which persists through the ages. And in scenes from Comus, there are, I think, magnificent evocations of history, always, of course, on the brink of blasphemy. Almost, I have walked the first step upon water. In a poem which says, I don't need to strain erudition, I mean the learned readers of J. Milton. J. Milton's very disconcerting, and not just because in another poem we meet H. Mirren. If Helen Mirren's going to become H. Mirren, there's something a bit strange about John Milton becoming J. Milton at that point. And the lines which speak of... there's a lovely sequence here where it goes... Speaking, of course, of Hugh Wood, it says, still, your music would arouse Milton for me. It's an absolutely lovely onomastic trick again. This W-O-U-L-D across the line is not W-O-O-D. But it's a poem which moves to Milton, begins with the word titograms in the first line, and ball's ache, and then moves to Milton in the course of it, and takes in a kind of happy swipe at not just Milton, but at Houseman. When he says, goes from Senna's called on more than single malt into arousing Milton. Malt does more than Milton can to justify God's ways to man, how Houseman says. And so, but it does remind you that that's not true of all gods. I mean, that is, there are very important gods for whom malt is the work of the devil. So, the poem by Geoffrey Hill I especially go to is the one that's called On Reading Milton and the English Revolution, where it seems to me there has to be at least a sly pleasure in the fact that the author of that book is called Hill. So that you can move from one hill to another. And it's a poem, that's the poem which has H. Mirren suddenly in it, and which ends with, but to go out with all that ragged history turmoiling in your wake, a load of screw wrath. Regret cannot now get closer to target. Sibylline interdict spells blunder. Resign, though resignation itself proclaims the finder. cryptic lines, but they're all about ragged history, and especially about the whether we can do better by history. You think of how often history, especially the history of the Second World War, though not that alone, is the animating animosity in a lot of recent Geoffrey Hill work. I'll just end with a certain sort of reminder that Milton's influence is as much in prose as in poetry. That is, his influence on Melville is absolutely extraordinary. His influence on Mailer is absolutely extraordinary. His influence on Beckett is absolutely extraordinary. When you read, just give you a little bit of Beckett, in Malone Dies, there's a choir to be heard. They must be rehearsing. It belongs already to the long past. It has uttered for the last time the triumphal cry on which it ends. Can it be Easter week? Thus, with the year, seasons return. If it can, could not this song I've just heard, which quite frankly is not yet quite stilled within me, could not this song have simply been to the honour and glory of him who was the first to rise from the dead, to him who saved me 20 centuries in advance? Did I say the first? The final ball lends colour to this view. B-A-W-L. Final ball lends colour to this view. Excellent English heroic line, Miltonic line, and so on. Can it be Easter week? Thus with the year seasons return. Capital S in it to remind you of the line ending without having to put in a slash. Seasons are not capitalised, yet they're at the beginning of the line there. Now, who is the first to rise from the dead? It's not Jesus Christ. It's Lazarus. I think Beckett is thinking about Lazarus, and a lot of modern poetry has thought that Lazarus was badly treated by the Lord, brought back to life and didn't actually wish to be. Berryman writes very well about this and so on. At least it's all sort of over, basta, and so on, and then it's not allowed to be over. Here's a short poem by James Henry, Conversation Between Two People, 8 lines long. Like as an egg's life's two ends to each other, blind, helpless, speechless at one end we enter, not knowing where we are or whence we come, blind, helpless, speechless, exit at the other. Who has come back to tell us why and whither? Lazarus, for one. And what did Lazarus say? Nothing. Seemed not to know he had been away. Now, I think it's a wonderful last line of a poem, because of seemed. If it said he seemed, no, nothing seemed not to know he'd been away. It's an absolutely extraordinary tone for a Victorian poem, it seems to me. But I'm going to end with a 20th century poem. It's on the tercentenary of Milton's death, not on the quotacentenary of Milton's birth. But in a curious way, it doesn't make any difference whether you're celebrating. You find this with centenaries. You're celebrating something, birth, death, big deal. In the end, there are birth pangs, there are death pangs, and so on. So this is by Gavin Newart of Christ's College on the tercentenary of Milton's death. It begins with a particular blasphemy, which is put Milton in the vicinity of E.J. Thribb, of Private Eye, the author, you'll remember, of the poem about John Wayne, our John Wayne, not the American one, which goes like this: so farewell then, John Wayne, you were not the famous one. one of the great 20th century obituaries and so on. Or the one on Norman Mailer: so farewell then, Norman Mailer, you wrote The Naked and the Dead, you had 5 wives and 8 children. You must often have been naked. Now you are dead. So these are the works of E.J. Thribb, and Gavin Ewart begins on the tercentenary of Milton's death. E. Jarvis Thribb, that's very good. It's like J. Alfred Prufrock and some. E. Jarvis Thribb, 17, and Keith's mum don't reckon you. Even students of English get lost in your syntax. The long sentences and the Greek idioms he knew to build confuse the lover of what's simple. The multitudinous classical allusions just fill them with boredom. Eliot's hypothesis was that your magniloquence led on to Wordsworth and Coleridge, poets who could write or talk the hind leg off a donkey. You didn't have much use for humour, wit vanished early from your verse in any sense, and rhyme you thought barbarous. Perhaps in your day nothing much was funny, as now in Ulster, and how could you have the needed detachment? But like a rocket, you took off for outer space and the SF demons. You really did go into overdrive. No short-haul aircraft, medium-range bomber or helicopter, but a giant blockbuster. So for this kind of verse, which has a genuine grandeur, you are the best one. Words of dim mountains are only molehills, I think, compared. You truly invented your own mighty language, like Ulysses' bone nobody else could handle. It bent them. Of course you took sides and suffered from it. If pride was your fault, still you had cause for that. The young undergraduate of Christ College combing his long blonde hair with an ivory comb, as well as arrogance, beauty. So I just end with Coleridge's thinking about education in schools and in universities. This is one of his marginalia again. He speaks of the strange one-sided representation of education, and he says, and the universities, even relatively to Oxford 30 years ago, it would have been slander. To Cambridge, as it now is, blasphemy. So that gives you a sense of the merits of the two universities. Thank you very much.
Has kindly agreed to accept a question or a comment or two. So I'll open the floor for that in a moment. While I'm waiting, I'll mention that this is the last of the lectures. This lecture and the previous four will be available on the college webpage. The previous four are there already as a podcast, and you'll be able to listen to this as a podcast as well. There's two more events concerned with our Milton Quattrocentenary. There's a concert in the hall, Milton in Christ's, on the 6th of December, and there are some tickets left for that. And the exhibition in the Old Library will continue until the 18th of December. But for now, any questions or comments for Professor Ricks?
I loved your play with deformation and deformation. Isn't that right? I mean, the question is a deformation, a deformation, then a defamation? I think poets, I mean, I'm not a poet at all. I think poets are always selling short their own work by giving an account of it. I mean, that is explaining. So that I think that the great poets have been very wary of explaining. They're sometimes driven to it by social circumstance without explanation and so on. So I think it's Wordsworth, the manifesto for lyrical ballads is not like lyrical ballads. Beckett's accounts of what he is doing fall far short of what he's actually doing. Pope spoke against puns. I mean, this is absolutely extraordinary thing. So that I think that is always sure to happen. I think that the Milton case, I think, is a bit different. I think you see Milton in the middle of a hideous and frightening turmoil about whether the divorce tracts are blasphemous. It's very, very important to him, therefore, to say blasphemy is not limited to... it's a certain kind of defence of blasphemy in the sense that it says blasphemy needs to be interpreted much more widely than such and such. And, of course, that's perfect. If you think that God is everything and is everywhere in some sense, then it's not clear what you could ever separate off. It's like the problem of the sacred and the profane. The profane presumably falls within the aegis of the sacred. But thank you. I'd like to think more about that. I liked your play of words, but I'm too given to liking my own.
any other comments or questions? This one.
Please.
I noticed that several times you used the words risk blasphemy, yeah. And coming up to that almost as though there were sort of inverted commas around it. And I wonder what you thought of whether you were alluding to maybe more modern poetry where that very phrase is used, where Heaney says, I could risk blasphemy, consecrating the golden bowl as a prayer to make Germany. Whether a poet renounces, as it were, into the text that what's coming next could be risking blasphemy, yeah. is taking the sting out of it, or underlined.
Yes, I've read Heaney. I didn't remember the phrase, you know what I mean? I think that if I compare it with Geoffrey Hill's Almost I Have Walked, that's the first step of one. I think the latter is greatly superior in not being explicit in the matter. That is the almost, it's like Geoffrey's extraordinary, and to me, I'm afraid, persuasive, since I had the opposite view, account of somehow in F.H. Bradley. And that is, I think that somehow is almost, if I can have that, almost always, somebody not facing the responsibility of his or her own argument. What Geoffrey has shown is that in Bradley, it's a very, very powerful conveyor of a certain sort of precision. That is, it's a very clear description of a necessary vagueness, like the opening of Marina, you know, which is it's wonderfully clear that the whole situation is extraordinarily indeterminable. I mean, what are these days? So I didn't know the meaning, and I think it might very well, there's a point at which you are nudged, isn't that right? There's a point at which the poet nudges you. Pope, of course, with that brilliant device of including a commentary on the Dunciad, is able to have straight-faced bores give you pieces of information to help you if you happen not to have picked it up, but if you had picked it up, you can think only a straight-faced bore would feel obliged to tell me that. So it works out very well from the problems of annotation, but thank you. I share your sense of this.
What strikes me is the relativity of
Bethlehem.
Yeah. Because it seems to me I'm sure it's obvious. It's a bit frightening, isn't it? But Dr. Johnson dared not give examples. If you want to give examples of blasphemy, and we take Beckett's ingenious blasphemy for granted. For example, sitting in a prayer session in Endgame, which ends as the bastard doesn't exist. I mean, it would be assumed at any other time. So that it's very difficult to talk about blasphemy. I mean, blasphemy without this.
I think part of the point is to give offence, isn't it? It's a little bit like if your Sanskrit were perfect, you wouldn't actually enjoy the wasteland nearly as much. Because you're meant to know what on earth, you have no idea what a shanty is at the end. You take the trouble to find out because Mr. Ellick gives notes. But if you were George Steiner, who knew all the languages in the world, with consummate inwardness, you'd find these poems really rather, you know, old hat, isn't that right? Whereas our difficulties with them do seem to be part of what they're enjoying, as when Beckett will give you the verb to defunge. Sufficient times of the day, let us first defunge. Then we'll see. Now, defunct has never gone defunct, but defunge has never even been born. So there's this very strange way that as soon as we know the word well, I'm afraid it doesn't have this wonderful frisson. But I think really everybody wants a drink.
I think I was taking. I'm sorry. I think I was taking no risk at all when I said at the beginning that Professor Richards is a compelling lecturer. I think we've seen again what we saw before when you were in Cambridge. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.